Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Bentley, and I'm joined today by my awesome co-hosts,
Ellie Lane
and
Laura Rosenbaum.
Awesome. All right. And we are joined today by a very special co-host and special guest with us today, Mr. William Hoffman with Hoffman's Exterminating out of New Jersey. Bill, thanks so much for agreeing to join us today on the podcast.
I'm excited to be here.
We did not pay him to say that, I promise. Bill, I know that that we all know you and we get a lot of opportunities to spend some time with you, but do us a favor and tell us a little bit about who you are, where your company's located, how long you've been in business, and anything else you want to share with us today.
Sure. I'm one of the guys that's just been in business forever. You know, I know I don't look it, but I've been in business for 44 years now, starting out 17 years old as a summer helper, kind of just figuring out what I wanted to do for my life, and found that I was making a little bit of money and I liked it. So kind of stuck with it and stuck it out with a regional company and kind of grew up in the business a little bit, and then decided to start my own company about 34 years ago out of, you know, like everybody else does, out of the backseat of the car, and grow one customer, one employee at a time. And, you know, now we're proud to say that we're, you know, one of the larger Philadelphia-based pest control companies in the area. It's servicing South Jersey, Philadelphia, and Delaware with about 100 great employees and six service centers, and servicing both residential and commercial businesses.
That's awesome. So you started the company yourself from scratch?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
That's amazing. So did you have any idea that eventually you were going to grow to the size that you are, or was it just, we're just going to kind of go, you know, keep on the path and see where this goes from there?
Now, you know what the interesting thing was, Mike, is I was doing pest control, you know, most of my career. And then I got into management before I left and started my own company. And I really wanted to stay in leadership role, management role. And I had a vision of starting a business rather than just a job. So when I put my business plan together back in 1990, I actually developed a business plan thinking, hey, what would I have to do to get the next employee, the next customer, and where would I want to be to get a team developed underneath of me that I could continue this as long as I wanted to? And that was the vision. It's kind of funny. So when we look back at that, I bring that out every few years and dust it off and realize we pretty much stayed honored to that. We just try to do good service, get good people, do honest service. And we kept growing. And, you know, I always say you have to have a vision, and we had it. And people I have with me continue to have that vision. And now they're helping me grow, and we continue to grow every year.
That's awesome. Yeah, I would definitely say that leadership and guidance is a sweet spot of yours. You know, certainly I know plenty of folks in the industry lean on you for business expertise and some mentoring as well. So, you know, you've certainly done a lot to give back to the industry. Now, for anybody that, you know, everybody listening, you can't see Bill's background for his Zoom right now. So, Bill, you mentioned Philly. Are you an Eagles fan?
We are. We are a great sports company, I would say. We're a great Eagles fan, and not just a fan, but we're the official exterminating of the Philadelphia Eagles in Lincoln Financial Field. So that's a proud moment for us. And we also support we're also a proud partner of the Philadelphia Flyers and the Philadelphia Union, which is the MLS soccer team in the area. So, you know, we're a sports company, I would say. So we're engaged in one sport from one season to the other. There's not a gap in between any of those franchises.
Oh man, do you have any cool stories of like meeting the players or their coaches or anything?
Yeah, I got a lot. You know, one of my favorite stories is you know, I get to meet a lot, but Jason Avant is a dear friend of mine, and he's you know, he was a wide receiver for the Eagles, and he was known to go across the middle and take a blow, but he now owns a trampoline park in our area, and he does this ultimate dodgeball on trampolines. And if you have the guts to go up against Jason and his team, that I swear to all athletes, so he will challenge any corporate company to come into a trampoline park and play ultimate dodgeball. And if you've never been hit by a dodgeball by a football player, it's something to remember, because first of all, I don't care how bad you throw at the ball at him, to him, away, he catches the ball because obviously he was a wide receiver. But you know, when you watch a bunch of people hit the trampoline, fall, try to pick up a ball and get hit in the back of the head and do another flip, it was amazing. So, and he is as competitive in that kids trampoline park as he was on any NFL field ever.
I have never been more excited to learn about something in my entire life.
Yeah, it is. I don't care how great. I know, Mike. I see you at the gym. You're a great athlete, but you feel like you're about 95 years old when you get off of that trampoline. Let me tell you.
All right. Well, Bill, I've been called a lot of things in my life. An athlete is not one of them normally. So I appreciate you saying that. And I'll definitely get you that money for that nice compliment later. So you mentioned that companies can challenge them. So is this like a standing thing? How does, hypothetically, asking for a friend, does an organization say approach said past Eagles athlete challenge them to this duel of death?
Yeah, you can rent the space for corporate events. You know, it's kind of funny. He you know, it's a trampoline park. So the first thing people think of, you know, you're gonna have little Joey's birthday party there with a bunch of screaming kids and birthday cake. But when he's part of our local chamber of commerce. So as business people are like, oh my God, this would be a great backdrop for a corporate event. So we started doing it, and it's a trampoline park. So he goes, well, who wants to get on the trampoline and bounce? You know, well, of course, all the, you know, everybody kicks off their dress shoes. And so then we start saying, he goes, did you ever play dodgeball? And he's like, no, we never. He says, then he starts. Then he goes, well, you think you're good? You think you're good at, you know, dodgeball? And of course, everybody's like, oh, I'm really good at dodgeball. I was a volleyball player. I was this and that. But then he sucks you in, is what he does. He sucks you in. It's the best trash talking any football player can do. But he trash talks you in there, get up and start jumping and throwing the ball around and thinking you're really good. And then he says, well, let me get on the other side and show you how it works. And that's it. And I've been on there where there's him and eight of us. And within minutes, we're all laying on the ground holding our heads or our bellies or something. And he's gone, you want to do it again?
And those trampoline parks are exhausting too. I've been to a couple before, and you're like, I could jump forever. And then like 5 minutes later, it's like,
yeah. So how it works, you start on a wall, you jump down into the trampoline, up, there's another wall halfway, and then you jump up and grab a ball, jump up on trampoline, back on a wall, throw it across the field. And of course, it doesn't work, because if you ever do a trampoline park with yourself, it's hard enough. Well, when you're bouncing, somebody else is bouncing on the same trampoline in opposite times, it feels like your legs just wobble out from underneath you. You have no control whatsoever. You think you're going to bounce.
I was going to say, I'm having flashbacks to like bouncy castles right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. The legendary double bounce on the trampoline where you get sent way too high when you weren't expecting it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you, it is really hard to focus on the rest of what we're supposed to do.
Sorry about that one.
No, because no. This is life-changing information for me, Bill.
Yeah.
I'm going to need to get some more information from you after we finish the episode.
You got it.
I'm not kidding. Oh, this sounds awesome. So it sounds like you and the company have done this before.
Not my company. I did it with a bunch of business leaders, which was probably, I should have brought some of my younger technicians who are more in shape than a bunch of business leaders who basically eat donuts and coffee every morning for meetings. So probably wasn't the best. I didn't plan it real well. I put it this way. I should have got my 20 something year old guys to come out with me on that day.
Well, if you ever need some assistance, let me know.
Got it.
We're going to be talking about how to set this up later. I
promise. Road trip.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll
get Jim Fredericks up there too.
You go. Yeah, he's got some long arms. We could use him out there. Awesome. Really can't thank you enough for being a part of this. I think we'll go ahead and get started. Laura, you want to go ahead and explain a little bit about what we're about to do and prepare Bill for a way less extreme version of of a game? Yeah.
I was about to say, hopefully your legs won't hurt as much after this, but maybe your brain will. But anyway, so each of us is going to have 5 minutes to tell you about the coolest thing that we found this month in entomological science. And so we'll go ahead and do our summary. We'll pause for questions. You can ask us as many questions as you want concerning whatever we talked about. And then at the end of all this, you get to pick who you think did the best job. So Mike is going first because he's been smug all month about his win last month. So
lies. I'm humble.
So winner. Whenever you're ready, Mike.
Okay. All right. So yeah, we're each going to have 5 minutes. I'm just getting my timer ready here. We do take the time personally and seriously. So we will, we won't cut each other off, but we will definitely throw some shade on anybody that goes along. So I'm just getting my timer ready to make sure that I'm ready to go here. So,
and our time begins after we read the title, because some of these titles can be real long. So
yeah, luckily I picked a paper this month that the title is short and I can pronounce all of the words in it. But I'm not going to read the names of the authors, and I'm probably going to do a horrible job pronouncing the university where the research took place. So I'm going to apologize and give you that caveat all in advance. All right. So the title of my paper that I'm going to talk about is The Use of Artificial Intelligence for Automated Detection and Surveillance of Red Imported Fire Ants. All right. So I have covered research on the red imported fire ant, Solenopsis invicta, already in a couple episodes in the past. So I'm going to keep my description here about them and what they are pretty brief. But the Cliff Notes version is that the red imported fire ant is an incredibly aggressive and damaging ant species to non-native ecosystems. It's native to South America, and it slowly made its way around the world thanks to various methods of human-mediated transportation, such as through the import and export of landscape goods. Unfortunately, we are to blame for most of the spread of this ant around the world, and we're still doing so to this day. To give you some context here as to the financial scale of damages that we're talking about from just this one species, the red imported fire ant ranks as the fifth costliest invasive species globally, accounting for approximately $17 billion in economic damages and management costs over the past few decades. Now, key to stopping or slowing the spread of really any invasive species is through early detection, but finding stowaway ants and transported goods can be really tough. In the past, detection methods to stop the red imported fire ant included things like physical inspections of those transported goods and visual surveillance to locate mounds and foraging workers in fields where they've become invasive. Both options can be effective, but there's always the potential for human error, as reproductive ants hidden in transported goods can be hard to find, easy to miss, and smaller, newer mounds that are recently developed may be hard to identify as well. Now, researchers from China's Lanzhou University, I think that is how it's pronounced. I apologize to all of the folks from that university if I just pronounced that incorrectly. They set out to improve fire ant surveillance by removing the human element altogether with the help of advanced robotics and artificial intelligence. The team trained up an AI, open source AI system with sophisticated algorithms to identify red imported fire ant nests. And they did this by uploading over 1,000 images taken of nest mounds from various angles and conditions. Now, I'm not going to break down the complicated science behind it because I obviously don't understand that science very well. But I will tell you, though, is that all the different algorithms that they tested and all have different names. And the name of the technology that they used was the YOLO-X algorithm. So I can definitely appreciate the sense of humor here of the computer scientists. But so once the AI system was selected and it was trained, they integrated it into a state-of-the-art robotic cyber dog that came equipped with a bunch of sophisticated sensors, things like imaging software and all sorts of stuff that allow it to process the surrounding environment and to compare that information to existing reference data set of the fire ant mounts they've uploaded. That actually tests the performance of the ant-detecting robo-canine against humans. Researchers gave the cyber dog and three different human surveyors 10 minutes to inspect a 300 square meter nursery for red imported fire ant mounts. Now, one kind of fun note here to add to this is the cyber dog's detection protocol was that once it found a potential mound, it would go up and poke at the mound with its front paw, so to speak, to potentially stir up the nest. And then if there was any additional ant activity that was found, it was evaluated, and this helped to enhance the accuracy of detection. Now, at the end of the survey period, the cyber dog found three times as many nests as its human counterparts. In addition, the cyber dog missed fewer nests and also had a lower false detection rate than its human counterparts. Now, having said all that, this technology is still in the early developmental phases, and it likely also comes with a pretty heavy price tag. I looked up just to see how much it would cost to buy one of these cyber dogs for myself, because frankly, they look pretty awesome. And it's going to cost thousands of dollars just to purchase one of these things. So the idea of wide scale deployment right now is probably pretty far off. But Imagine though, in a not so distant future, I think this does give us a lot of hope for what these surveillance protocols could look like down the road. So imagine in a not so distant future, you pull up to your client's home to perform the regular service. Now, before going inside to chat with your client, you deploy your CyberDog Pest Detector 1000, side note, that is a totally made up name I just came up with, to inspect the exterior of the structure and the surrounding property. By the time you finished up on the inside, you walk outside and your CyberDog has prepared a detailed report of pest activity. It's mapped out locations and treatment recommendations for each incident logged. Now, this is all hypothetical, of course, but based on the direction that technology and AI are currently heading, this may not be as so much of a far-fetched idea as it sounds. I will stop there with my wonderful dad joke at 4 minutes and 40 seconds. Don't you boo me. You are jealous of that amazing joke. All right, so cyber dogs and AI, Bill, you ready to sign up for it?
I'm telling you, interesting stuff, isn't it? AI is scary and interesting and scary at the same time.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Well, and I know, I mean, you do a lot of work in the commercial space, so remote monitoring, that kind of thing. You know, that's we're starting to see a lot more of that in our industry. But this is a pretty interesting application of some of this more remote technology and remote sensing technology and detection technology in a non-commercial space. So pretty interesting.
Yeah, we see a lot of we do a lot of food processing, we do a lot of farms, we do a lot of fresh fruit cut. And we're seeing a lot of AI come into that market to almost same thing, detect peaches if it's rotted on the inside with AI technology. So if you ever want to, funny stories before I got pest control, I did some peach packing back in the day. You know, be 100 of us on a production line and grabbing that peach that didn't quite look good and throw it into another box. And that would go to the pig farms. But now there's AI technology we're seeing in two or three of our accounts that then things are going through super fast, and AI is not just looking at the outside, the color, the shape, but somehow looking at the inside to determine if there's any kind of imperfections inside and kicking it out at milliseconds and grading them to the point that the farmer now gets a grade, if you think, a report card on, hey, you sent us, you know, X amount of peaches and 3% had some kind of rot, spores, worms, something on the inside. It allows the farmers then to make corrective actions on their crops, which is crazy stuff.
That's super cool.
That is really cool. It is really interesting to see all those uses of AI and all that technology. I mean, talking about with the ants, you know, it makes me think about, like you mentioned, you know, our, you know, places like a commercial nursery, like in this case, you know, you hear about some of the drones that they use for certain types of monitoring, but getting something actually on the ground. And then maybe if that gets integrated to this idea, like you said, of like those farmers were getting grades for, you know, how much, how well their peaches were doing. I mean, maybe these nurseries get grades on like how they're managing their pests or how, you know, because stuff like fire ants, I mean, that's a danger to workers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did they give a sense of like how sensitive the dog was? Like, you know, depending on the size of the nest.
Yelled at? I don't understand.
It just started crying when you brought up something.
It cowers over any loud. they may have. I will be perfectly honest with you. There was a lot of jargon in this article that was a bit over my head. They dove into the complicated algorithms, what made one algorithm better than the others. There was about four or five different ones that they tested. I would imagine that there was a lot of sensitivity in built into those and how well it processed these images. It was pretty interesting that they collected and accumulated a lot of these images on their own. That they kind of train this AI system on. And my guess is that much like any AI system that's out there, the whole idea behind that is it continues to improve over time as it adds more images to its own and its own database. And then any confirmed detection would then kind of add to that catalog of yeses versus nos. And so I would expect that maybe its sensitivity and its ability to detect and the confirmation rate would go up over time. But I don't know if that actually answers your question or not.
You would know better than I was.
That's what I was able to glean from the reading. So the YOLO X.
I also
have new favorite algorithm.
I have this great image in my head of this like this robotic dog in my head. It's like a lab or something, and it's using its little paw to like poke at the nest. I mean, is it, I guess the idea there is it agitates if mm-hmm. there's any ants there, and then it can like see their movement, I guess.
Yep, absolutely. So, I mean, there's, you know, for anybody that's not familiar, the red imported fire ant makes this characteristic mound shaped nest. And when you come across a field that is fully infested with red imported fire ants, you could just see mound after mound after mound for, you know, forever. But the challenge is when these mounds are really small, and there's a lot of other organisms that may create a similar mound, a dirt mound. It could be, you know, hedgehogs and those groundhogs, those kinds of things, like squirrels, just as they're starting to push up dirt. So it's part of that confirmation process. So once they identify something that kind of checks off all the boxes, yes, this could be a fire ant mound, it then walks up and then pokes at it. And then if there's additional activity that's detected after that from the ants, that is used as an additional confirmation that it is a red imported fire ant mound.
Yeah. See, I'm visualing like the Wizard of Oz where the dog's out there and it's saying, oil, when it's in the yeah. or, you know, something like that, where something happened, the dog was out there too long, we didn't bring the wet dog in, you know, so then we got oil can and grease it up a little bit, make sure it keeps walking back.
Yeah. Well, I would tell you, I mean, the one thing that I didn't really dive into about this, but was something that I thought of as a consideration, you know, long-term, I mean, these things are pretty expensive. Some ants are known to chew on and do some damage to electrical systems on electrical wires and stuff. If anybody's ever been the unlucky and unfortunate recipient of any red imported fire ant mound activity, they swarm very fast. They instantly leave the nest, and it's no holds barred. Like every ant moves out to destroy. So I can see that I don't know how fast these robots are, but if it's not very fast, I could easily see that it could be swarmed by ants, and I'd be interested to see what that would do to the integrity of the robot long term. But
oh, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, any other questions for me, Bill, before we move on?
No, that was pretty interesting.
Okay, awesome. All right. Laura.
What a poker face.
I know. I'm not getting anything off this guy right now. All right, Laura, take it away.
All right. So I'm going to be talking about something a little different. So we're going to go to mosquitoes next. So this paper is from Somet et al. 2024. So this literally just came out this month, which is pretty great. And this was in the Royal Society for Proceedings B for Biology. But the title of my paper today is Mosquito Aging Modulates the Development, Virulence, and Transmission Potential of Pathogens. The transmission of pathogens from an invertebrate host, like a mosquito, to a vertebrate host, such as a human, is not always a hard and fast rule. There are several factors that can influence the success of transmission, such as the immune response of both the human and the mosquito to the pathogen, the type of pathogen, the level of infection of the pathogen in the mosquito, and more. However, one of the factors that has not been fully studied is the age of the insect host and how it can affect the success of transmission to the vertebrate host. Age can potentially be a huge factor in how pathogens are transmitted, as both the behavior and the biology of the insect host can drastically change across their lifetimes. This paper specifically looked at the effects of adult age of Anopheles clusii on the transmission of Plasmodium falciparum, or the protozoan parasite that causes malaria. Plasmodium falciparum is transmitted through the bite of female Anopheles mosquitoes when they blood feed to produce eggs. This particular species of protozoan is also known as the deadliest parasite in humans. The researchers raised Anopheles clusii mosquitoes in the lab and then provided them with a blood meal that was infected with Plasmodium falciparum either 12 days, 8 days, or 4 days post-emergence to adulthood. First, the researchers examined the ability of the different age groups of mosquitoes to act as a competent host for the parasite. This was done by counting the number of different life stages of the parasite that were visible when they dissected the adult mosquitoes after 8 days post-infection. The researchers found that the oldest mosquitoes, which were fed the infected blood meal at 12 days, featured the lowest number of parasites compared to the other two age groups. This suggests that mosquitoes exposed at a later age to the parasites are less likely to be successful hosts for the parasite. Similarly, the researchers also looked at the progression of the parasite's life cycle within the mosquito after feeding on the infected blood meal. The purpose of this part of the study was to determine if age of the mosquito influenced Plasmodium falciparum's development. The researchers found that despite the age differences within the mosquitoes, the development of Plasmodium continued at its normal pace and did not differ between mosquitoes exposed to Plasmodium falciparum at 4 days or 12 days post-emergence. The researchers also examined the combined effects of age and infection status on mosquito survival. The mosquitoes that fed on an infected blood meal either 4 or 8 days post-emergence showed no difference in survival compared to their uninfected counterparts. However, the mosquitoes that fed on the infected blood meal at 12 days post-emergence had a significantly longer lifespan compared to those uninfected. This suggests that Plasmodium may have a fountain of youth effect on older mosquitoes that gave them a median of an extra 2 days of survival. So, what does all this data tell us about age and how it affects transmission of pathogens in mosquitoes? Mostly, much like a Facebook status in approximately the late 2000s, it's complicated. While mosquitoes that were exposed to the parasite at a younger adult age still hold the crown for the highest transmission potential, it appears that there are confounding factors that can still make mosquitoes exposed at an older adult age just as capable of transmission. Although the mosquitoes exposed at an older age don't appear to be the best host for the parasite, the extended lifespan offers more potential for the mosquito to spread Plasmodium falciparum, especially when previous studies have shown that Anopheles mosquitoes infected with Plasmodium increase the number of times that they feed as well as the size of the meals that they take. Overall, this study reinforces the idea that mosquitoes exposed to a pathogen at an early age will be the most likely to spread that pathogen, but also suggests that mosquitoes exposed at a later age may not be as behind the ball in terms of transmission potential as we previously thought. If anything, this study has proven that age is not just a number, but an important factor to consider in disease transmission. Understanding the factors of how a pathogen may be passed on from an invertebrate host to a vertebrate host can dictate management strategies of not only the pathogen, but can also potentially dictate how and when we treat for these public health pests. 15 seconds. Left to spare. Got a little nervous.
So what else have they found out with the age of the mosquitoes? I mean, obviously. So it's just the potential risk, just like, I guess, humans. I mean, as people age, they're more susceptible and then non-susceptible. So it sounds like mosquitoes kind of have that same type of biology. Like, hey, young mosquitoes can get, you know, exposed, but it seems like they're changing the behaviors or trying to modify something because of either being exposed the Plasmodium or not.
Yeah. Yeah, so obviously with the younger mosquitoes, they have more potential for the parasite to develop and make it to the point where they could pass it on to the, you know, to a vertebrate host. But it turns out the older mosquitoes may be really pretty close in terms of the transmission potential that they have to pass on that disease to whatever host that they happen to feed on. Again, even though it's maybe not the best host for the parasite to be in, clearly they can still develop just fine, just at lower numbers. And also with those 2 extra days of survival, it's kind of wild because, again, that just means more time for the parasite to be out and about walking around in a mosquito and then walking right into a vertebrate host when that mosquito blood feeds. So,
yeah, it's almost like we've heard with some pesticides when talked about roach feeding, where some pesticides change the feeding patterns of roaches. So some pesticides exposed at certain times change the feeding patterns of roaches where they actually feed more or feed less.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So I thought it was a pretty cool paper because not a lot of papers look at insect age a lot. So
yeah, I thought that was really interesting too. I mean, in the scale of insect life cycles, 2 days is quite a good bit of time. you know, for a mosquito that's only going to live, a couple weeks, maybe 2 days is, I'm not sure what percentage wise that is of all that extra transmission potential. But I think if I'm understanding correctly, you're also saying that the older mosquitoes, while they still can, they still have the Plasmodium in them, the older the mosquito is, the less likely they are to successfully transmit that to a vertebrate host?
Not necessarily. Okay. I mean, yes and no. So what they're saying is that because the parasite might not be able to establish as well in the older mosquitoes because they didn't see as many life stages there, that's probably what's driving the lower potential and also the time factor too. But it, like, the model that they created, it literally was like two humps right next to each other in terms of the transmission potential that their model was assuming. So really kind of pretty not behind the eight ball on that one. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you kind of think about mosquito age and dog years, I guess, you know, thinking about like a couple extra days is like a whole extra year to a mosquito, really.
Yeah, it's bug years. We'll have to use that now.
Yeah, I mean, two days is definitely a long time. I'm trying to remember. I think it's like around 2 weeks is the average lifespan for an adult mosquito in the wild, maybe. It may even be a little bit shorter than that because they not a lot of them survive their first interaction with a host, right? That's their most dangerous time. So, I mean, if you're looking at like, you know, 14 days, 2 days is definitely a pretty significant chunk of your life. So,
yeah. That's awesome.
Nice work. All right. Bill, any more questions?
Yeah, I think that was the only question. I just love the idea that chemical responses can change both longevity sometimes of that pathogen staying within. Because you think about anything, any kind of, you know, I'm a honeybee guy. So you think about, God, imagine if something can let the honeybee live six more days. And how much, you know, or the opposite, you know, what happens if honeybees live six less days? And just to think about the pollination factor, think about the honey production of something like that, where, you know, if you're not studying the effects of something that's going in, you know, the pathogens or the biological chemical effect that's going in that insect, that, you know, you don't think about, hey, well, what difference does it make if a honeybee lives three less days? Well, you know, again, same type of correlation where, you know, how much pollination doesn't that honeybee do in those 3 days that their life was short, or the honey production? So, you know, I think this is going to go beyond mosquitoes. I think this is going to go beyond looking at, you know, when you have these insects that have such a short life cycle and the impact that a few days could mean on that insect itself and what they do. That, you know, we don't think of 2 days, what's the difference? But like I said, that's, you know, that's 20% of their lifespan, you know?
And I honestly was trying to do mosquito math to see like how many more people that would they bit. And I couldn't really find any good data on that, because it's not like anybody's like, let me track this one mosquito for 24 hours of my life.
Yeah, we just kind of correlate to the percentage. If they only live 2 weeks and you know, that's 20% of their time. So, you know, it's amazing. I correlate this, you know, just termites. I mean, what happens if termites, you know, live longer, you know, that they can, you know, because again, that reproductive process of the colonies is stress on the colonies. But if they live longer, you know, just like we do, like we live longer, so it puts less stress on everything.
Yeah, man, I am certainly happy to hear you say that you're a honeybee guy, because my paper actually does relate to honeybees. So this is a
pandering to the guest already. I see how
it's collusion.
I didn't know this.
Ellie trying to sweeten the deal over here.
Part two.
All right. Well, I'll get into it then. So this is a paper actually from Virginia Tech, which is where I went to school. So it was kind of cool for me to see this article by Cuvion et al. And so this was published in December, so pretty recent, within the past couple months. And the title of this paper is "A Volatilized Pyrethroid Insecticide from a Mosquito Repelling Device does not impact honeybee foraging and recruitment. Okay, so this paper is looking at the effects of mosquito-repelling thermocell devices that use pyrethroids. Pyrethroids are a class of insecticides that are derived from pyrethrum, which is from the chrysanthemum flower. And there's a lot of different pyrethroid products available. And in particular, this study is looking at active ingredient called prolethrin. And this works in mosquito repellent devices by volatilizing, so turning into a gas that can spread through the air and affect flying insects and the mosquitoes. Now, this aims to work on the mosquitoes, but since it's in the air, any other insects around that are flying, including beneficial pollinators, could fly by and potentially be affected. So honeybees are a common pollinator, as well as they're a great study organism. In case you weren't convinced that bees are really cool, one of my favorite bug facts is that bees are very trainable. They're not going to sit and roll over, but you can get them to feed at particular places. Another cool honeybee fact is that they are the second most studied organism on Earth besides humans. So also super cool. But anyways, this research is taking advantage of the fact that they're really trainable. And it based off of some other studies' methods of training, they got the experimental groups to learn where their particular feeder was and prompted them to go and forage there. So foraging behavior is a really good metric for determining if bees are affected by this product, because foraging relies on flight and dance communication of individuals. And since pyrethroids affect the nervous system of the insect, these behaviors would not perform well if the bees are affected by the product. Now, the experiment began with setting up a foraging area and training the bees to forage there. They placed the feeders close to the hive and stepwise moved them away to end up being about 100 meters final distance. And the researchers marked the bees as they foraged at the feeder in this training period with color and number coded plastic discs, so they could monitor the visits from each bee with cameras. So they split this feeder that they've now trained the bees to go to into two separate locations, equidistant to the hive. And one had the thermocell mosquito repellent device placed about 2 meters away from it. So that's within the effective area of the device. And the observational time and active device time was between 4 p.m. and 8 p.m., and this was during the summer, which is typical of when users might be deploying this device in residential areas like their patio in the evening. And the observations were recorded by camera, and the marked bees were able to be tracked down from the feeders and to the hive. They had one of those observational hives with like the clear glass on it, so they could see them going into the hive as well as the camera over by the feeder. There was also a concurrent deposition study performed to make sure the repellent devices were working properly, and they were exactly as intended. So that product was being dispersed correctly. Now, they found no significant difference between the control and treatment feeders and the various metrics of foraging to them. The different metrics they were looking at between the footage from the hive and the feeders were foraging frequency, waggle dance propensity, waggle dance frequency, and feeder persistency. So the waggle dance, if anyone's unfamiliar, is the series of movements honeybees perform in the hive to communicate the location of and other information about a feeding source, so telling the other bees where they're supposed to go. And other bees will go to the described location to forage. And so because there was no difference between what bees, the number of bees that were going to and from the different feeders, how often they were going, all of those different metrics, the conclusion is that the pyrethroid-based aerial mosquito repellent has no observable effect on honeybee foraging behavior. So that we can probably take to mean that it's safe for bees and the general public can use it without worry of affecting their local pollinators. Now, I do want to clarify this and say that this may not extend to every product in the pyrethroid class, But in lab tests, all the pyrethroids were more toxic to mosquitoes than they were to honeybees. So overall, this device could be a good option for residential areas, especially for those concerned about their local pollinators. And I think I'm just under 5 minutes.
Perfect. 2 seconds to spare.
That's awesome. Well, it's great that they were doing this test at night. And I know that we talk about that in the bee community all the time. Like, the mosquitoes and bees flight patterns are usually a little bit different. Mosquitoes are just about coming out at 4 o'clock or so, and bees are kind of heading home for the day.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to see if they try to do an experiment, during the day. It'd be interesting. Like, hey, what happens if you do this? For some reason, somebody calibrated a machine wrong and they're spraying from 8 o'clock in the morning till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Would that have the same type of effect on the bees as late dusk, or later evening than did there? Just to make sure that, it is not just a time of day study, that it's all, what happens if for some reason those bees are exposed all day long, because, these bees will go back and forth to that feeding site several times a day. So.
Yeah, that's definitely a really good point. Bees tend to be more active at different times than mosquitoes. They picked the time for the study because their idea was of when residents are most likely to be using the devices.
Right.
But there's plenty of people who would want to use it during, earlier hours of the day for whatever reason, so that would be interesting, especially with a prolonged exposure. So lots of potential for expansion of this study, and also potential for a more longer term study. This is just foraging behavior. We don't know from this study if there are any potential long-term effects on like lifespan, because we're only looking at it in a shorter amount of time. But they did find that typically things like this foraging response, they do tend to be affected if there is some sort of active ingredient that is, affecting the bees, that tends to affect their foraging behavior. So that's why they kind of picked that metric. But there's a lot more to be looked into.
Yeah. I mean, down here in South Jersey, we have a lot of daytime biting insects, not just mosquitoes, but a lot. And I could see people going, I'm turning that baby on. I wake up, get my coffee, that baby's going on, it's staying on.
Yeah. They also did make sure to, there's like the maximum rate of the product that is in the device, and they used, I believe, not just the maximum rate, but slightly over that in case there were to be like user error and someone accidentally puts like too much product in there. That's the amount they were used. So they were keeping an eye on using the potential for how much somebody could use at that time. But of course, that's still just in that time frame.
Yeah, because as having bees for years, bees are pretty tough. A lot tougher than people think they are. I mean, they're pretty resilient, pretty tough, and they do a lot to protect their hive itself. So we watch them all the time around. I mean, I have 6 hives here and a few at the offices, but it's amazing how tough they are. Our biggest problem usually is the giant hornets hovering around, but I have a little bit of fun with them. A little good badminton racket is a lot of fun with the old giant hornets around my beehives.
There you go. Or a dodgeball.
Yeah, yeah. Get Jason Avant there. Say, how good are you?
Awesome. Oh, good job, Ellie. All right, Bill, do you have any other questions for any of us before you make your final deliberations?
No, interesting. I mean, each one, like, you're talking about, invasive species, you're talking about, pathogens spread to, obviously people. And then you're talking about, which everyone's the biggest concern about as honeybees is, obviously our food protectors of the world. So it's interesting that you hit on all three areas. How do we protect our health? How do we protect our food? And how do we protect everything that we have coming around, especially, the invasive species, which for some reason, crazy. I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and I think the last 5-6 years, I've heard more about invasive species than in my first 40 years of being in the industry. It's like, it's amazing how fast things are changing. And, you talk to old time technicians and you talk about some of these new pests that we have to deal with in the Northeast, and like, when did they come here? I don't remember that. I'm like, well, they're here. Now we're stuck with them.
Yeah, well, I get a lot of flack around here because all I ever want to do is talk about invasive species and focus on invasive species because that's a lot of what I focused on for my research. But I mean, it's a problem that's been around for a long time and it will continue to get worse, unfortunately, I think. So,
Also, for the record, we did not plan to make that as full circle as you made it sound.
yeah, it was. It was. I wrote it down like, you know, we're talking about, you know, human health. We're talking about, you know, talking about potentially agricultural and thing, and we're talking about our food supply, you know, realistically.
Well,
I
I
mean,
mean, don't get me wrong. I will take the pat on the back. So, thank you. it's pretty representative of a day in the life of a PMP, right? That's what we're doing every single day out there in the field, protecting health,
Absolutely.
property, and food. So,
Absolutely. So, what is my job now? I got to pick the winner. I got to crown the ultimate.
yeah. So you have to make the difficult decision. We will not hold it against you personally. We only hold grudges against each other and ourselves. So you will be loved and hailed a hero among us, regardless of your decision. So don't sweat it.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I do think that most interesting, even though I'm a honeybee thing, is the AI technology, not just for the firearms, but I do think the AI technology is going to revolutionize how we do things in this industry. I hate to give it to Mike because he didn't look good with that crown. You know, I believe that crown on somebody else. But I do believe the AI technology. And I'm a honeybee keeper. I think we're going to use AI technology even for the honeybees. I mean, we're kind of doing it, not AI, but you know, we're taking for internally, we're taking temperature inside the hives. We're looking at the weight of the hive. We're looking at, you know, the insect counts of what's going on and things like, you know, how much sunlight is that hive getting? What you know, and where I'm at, we're getting these straight line winds in the Northeast that in the last 5 years, it's all we hear about, straight line winds and these tornadoes. And we're seeing that that's dramatically affecting the honeybees because of, you know, that wind's pounding them. So I think AI technology is going to be a very, very important part of the pest control industry as much as chemical technology and resistance of insects. I think AI technology is going to be something that we're going to be, you know, I see the next entomology going to have a computer degree is what's going to happen. I could see, you know, entomology have to have a computer degree to understand what's going on in the industry. So
Bill,
I
I love you, buddy.
don't
For a listener, Mike slowly crowned himself, like what? Didn't Napoleon crown himself?
And look what happened to him.
I know. I was gonna say, there's a good chance that for anybody listening, if I'm no longer heard from again, and I have some sort of terrible accident after this episode airs, know that it was probably one of my two colleagues on this podcast, but now I was fully prepared to run out and officially crown the winner if for anybody else. So
He did the old sap, the old dog pawing at the mound. You know, he really laid on the old dog thing. You know, a little doggy pawing at the, and the dog's gonna get attacked by the fire ants, and the poor dog's gonna run around yelping, and you know. It's
it's all that
always just
secondary
because
and
of that dad
tertiary
joke.
information. What's
Yeah.
that? What'd you say, Laura?
I'm
I said
surprised
it
he
was
didn't have
just
a
because
fur
of that
dog.
dad joke.
That's right.
I'm surprised a little fur dog didn't come up out of the screen, like just holding like a little pound puppy or something like that and petting it, you know?
I'm telling you, look, I looked up how much those things cost, and I certainly can't afford one. So,
Yeah.
I mean, you see the budget we're working on with this horrible crown thing that I've got here. So,
It's like one step above Burger King crown for those of you who cannot see.
I think a Burger King paper crown is nicer than the trash that I currently have on my head right now. So.
Hey, and the funny thing is, everybody's complaining about all these young kids spending too much time on their phones or computers, and I think that might be creating the next AI entrepreneurs out there
Yeah.
because that's they're going to understand it 10 times fold than we already do because that's they're doing it every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I for one really appreciate you being on the show today, Bill. Thanks for I learned a lot from this episode. Most excitedly, aside from the awesome research that both Laura and Ellie covered today, I learned what I'm going to be begging and pleading our organization to do as a team building exercise.
Yes.
And or I will be coming to visit you very soon, and we will bring the heat
There you
to
go.
the next ultimate dodgeball experience. We will win. We will come up with a strategy, and we will win this dodgeball game. Well, Bill, thanks so much for coming, man. We really, really appreciate you agreeing to be on here today and be subjected to some heavy science. And thanks for the great questions and the contributions. And most importantly, thanks for everything you do for the industry, all that you've given back as a mentor to folks, and certainly for what you do for us as an organization and as a protector of public health, property, and food. So we really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me on here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Bill. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye now.
All right, everybody, that is a wrap for another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites.
If you are interested in hearing more about any of the research we cover on the podcast, be sure to check out our pestology blog. You can find the blog at npmapestology.com, and we'll also have a link in the description of this podcast.
And be sure to like and rate the podcast, leave feedback if you have any, and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the release of a new episode. Thanks for listening.
NPMA Bug Bites is the industry's source for the latest in science news and pest control research. It's brought to you by the National Pest Management Association. You can find links to the science discussed in this episode, as well as technical and business resources, training opportunities, and information about careers in pest control by visiting npmatraining.org.